concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. The December 18th meeting of the Board of Directors will be held at 6 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm/board-directors.
KBOO provides free training in all aspects of operating a radio station. We're looking for folks who benefit from white privilege to attend the Beloved Community 101 training on Saturday, December 16th from noon to 3 p.m. This workshop focuses on understanding how KABU culture and our programming culture affect the station. How do we keep the program charter alive? How do we keep each other accountable on the air and off the air? If you're interested, please RSVP by email to del@kabu.org for a seat and for the location of the training. Again, that's the Beloved Community 101 training on Saturday, December 16th from noon to 3 p.m., hosted by your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland.
It's 9 o'clock. Good morning. This is KBOO Portland, and here's what's coming up this morning for public affairs until noon. Coming right up, it's Veterans Voice, dealing with matters of war and peace as well as health issues, the after effects of war, and today a focus on the U.S. military budget and other matters of concern. Then at 10 o'clock, it's Valley Views, 10:15 Flashpoints, 11 o'clock, Radio Zine presents Making Contact. All that coming up on your community radio station, KBOO. And thanks for listening. Here comes Veterans Voice.
Well, how do you do, Private Willie McBride? Do you mind if I sit here down by your graveside? And I'll rest for a while in the warm summer sun. I've been walking all day, Lord, and I'm nearly done. And I see by your gravestone you were only 19 when you joined the glorious fallen in 1916. Well, I hope you died quick, and I hope you died clean. Or Willie McBride, was it slow and obscene? Did they beat the drums slowly? Did they sound the fife lowly? Did the rifles fire o'er ye as they lowered ye down? Did the sing the last post in chorus? Did the pipes play the flutes or the forest? And did you leave a wife or a sweetheart behind? In some faithful heart is your memory enshrined? And though you died back in 1916, to that loyal heart are you forever 19? Or are you a stranger without even a name, forever enshrined behind some glass pane in an old photograph torn and tattered and stained and fading to yellow in a brown leather frame? Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they sound the fife lowly? Did the rifles fire o'er ye as they lowered you down? sing the last post in chorus. Did the pipes play the flute to the forest? Well, the sun's shining now on these green fields of France. The warm wind blows gently and the red poppies dance. The trenches have vanished long under the plough. No gas and no barbed wire, no guns firing now. But here in this graveyard, it's still no man's land. The countless white crosses in Ute witnessed to man's blind indifference to his fellow man, and a whole generation who were butchered and damned. Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they sound the fife lowly? Did the rifles fire o'er ye as they lowered you down? Did the bugles sing the last post in chorus? Did the pipes play the flutes of the forest? And I can't help but wonder, now Willie McBride, do all those who lie here know why they died? Did you really believe them when they told you the cause? Did you really believe that this war would end wars? Well, the suffering, the sorrow, the glory, the shame, the killing, the dying, it was all done in vain. For Willie McBride, it all happened again, and again, and again, and again, and again. Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they sound the fife lowly? Did the rifles fire o'er ye as they lowered you down? Did the bugles sing the last post in chorus? Did the pipes play the flutes of the forest? Did the bugles sing the last post in chorus? Did the pipes play the flutes or the forest?
Welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River, and 104.3 FM Corvallis and Albany. You can hear KBOO on the World Wide Web at kboo.fm, and you can also hear some of our earlier shows at kboo.fm/Veterans Voice, one word. I'm Marvin, and I'm here with Mike. Hello, Michael.
Hey, good morning, Marvin. Good to see you. Good to be on the air.
Yeah. Mike's going to read some stuff out of some books about Vietnam. He's got some poems and stuff he's written. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about how we were affected when we came back from Vietnam, which is pretty interesting. We're going to talk about that. But I have, at the last show we did, I got a phone call right after the show from Phil. And I wrote Phil's phone number down, and I lost it, Phil. And that's the only reason I didn't call you back. I'm really, really, really sorry. And I've looked all over for that phone number, pal, and I'm sorry. But here's the phone number for you that you can give to your brother. It's Montana Department of Veterans Affairs, and their phone number is 406-248-8579. That's Montana Department of Veterans Affairs, 406-248-8579. And again, I'm really, really sorry. I wrote that on the back of an envelope, and boy, it just ran away or something. I don't know what happened to it. And again, I'm really, really sorry. So I hope that will help your brother get some help up there. The other day, I was listening to the radio, and they were talking about the military budget of this country, and in 2015, I believe the military budget was something like $578 billion, and they just came out with them. You know, I used to have these things with Laurel, my late wife Laurel. She was a English professor at a university, so she always wanted to know. And I said they, and so we had these long conversations about who they were, you know. And finally, I got her to, you know, believe they were a they. And they just came out with the military budget for next year. It's $700 billion. $700 billion for the military budget for next year. And if you look at that, if you do a pie chart and cut it right down in half, the U.S. is right on that right side. More than you add up all of the other military budgets in the whole world, and they do not come to what the United States pays on their military budgets. $700 billion. And where do they get that money? They take it out of important things like child care, you know, education, things to help the people who need fuel oil in the winters, you know, all this really social services that we need in this country bad. And that's where they just like nickel and dime it, you know, till they get up to their $700 billion. And who suffers for that? You know, the average American worker, the average American person, that's who it is, you know. And then I heard that they came out again and said that they're going to start working on Medicaid and Medicare, you know. And they don't understand, you know, the American people don't understand that they paid into that. That came out of their paycheck, every paycheck. That money came out. It is not part of the American budget. That is private. It's in a private thing. That's just for that specific thing, you know. And the government tries to make you think that that's part of the military. I mean, part of the budget. Well, it's not, you know. And if they would pay back the money they borrowed out of that fund, you know, we wouldn't have any problem. But they borrow out of that fund all the time, and they don't pay it back. You know, and it's like, oh, we're going to have trouble in the year at such and such and such. Well, pay back the money you owe it, and it won't be that problem. You know, that's what they do. They just borrow out of it, and they don't pay it back. So pay it back so that grandma and grandpa and these disabled children and people can get what they deserve. You know, give it back. You took it out, pay it back. So that's my rant for a few minutes here, Mike.
You know, what you're saying reminds me of something that Martin Luther King said in a speech he gave on April 4th, 1967, at Riverside Church in New York City. And he was talking about the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And so he made two statements that were very significant for me and for a lot of people. He said, "The greatest purveyor of violence in the world today is my own government." Yep. That was one statement he made. And the other one, which dovetails into exactly what you're talking about, Marvin, he says, and he was referring to the United States, he said, a nation that year after year spends more money on military defense than it does on programs of social uplift is facing spiritual death. And of course, we all know that a year to the day, on April 4th, 1968, he was murdered in Memphis.
Yeah. I was in Vietnam when Dr. King was murdered, and that was a terrible day. You know, I remember all of my brothers, you know. And back then in Vietnam, and plus the country, they called themselves Black. You know, remember Black Brothers? They called they were Black Brothers. You know, Bloods. They called each other Bloods and Black Brothers. And I just to see the look on the faces of our brothers, it was just devastating, Mike. It was just devastating to see the look on these guys' faces.
You know, I can't imagine, because I got there, you know, a couple of years after you were there, and I certainly, you know, served with a lot of Black soldiers in my unit. In fact, you know, they educated me about American imperialism, and they certainly educated me about racism.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but I can't imagine what that was like, being out in the field with Black soldiers when they found out that Martin Luther King had been assassinated.
Yeah, it was really, really, you could just feel, you know, the sorrow that our brothers had, and it was just really hard.
Because you can imagine the DMZ that was created between white soldiers and Black soldiers in Vietnam when something like that happened. You know, as devastating as that assassination was, and what it meant to Black soldiers in Vietnam.
Yeah, it was hard
because, you know, it just reminds me of when I got to Vietnam. I had not been in my unit very long when a soldier walked up to a captain on a firebase, and he murdered him with his M16. And I remember right after that there was this separation between the enlisted men and the officers.
Oh, big time!
And you could feel the resentments. And I'm sure that you probably obviously experienced that, with the Black soldiers having resentments against just simply white people.
Yeah.
And, you know, the establishment.
Yeah, it was really interesting. In the field, it was really, I mean, we were tight in the field because we counted on each other so much, you know. And we talked a lot, you know. And a few of the guys that I hung around a lot, my Black brothers, we would talk a lot about stuff, you know, and they talked a lot about, you know, here I am fighting over here, and when I get home, I'm not going to be able to find a job.
Exactly.
You know, I'm going to be treated as a second-class citizen, and why am I doing this, you know?
Right.
And just talking to these guys, you know, and talking about their home life, you know, the stuff they never got, you know, the good educations, the good jobs, and different things like that, you know. You could just feel it, and then when Dr. King got murdered, when Dr. King got murdered, it was just this, you know. And I remember after he'd gotten murdered, we did stand down. That means in the stand down, they bring your unit back into a fire support base, and you get, you get refitted. Actually, you get you know, more ammunition and food and everything like that, and you get a few days to rest. It's basically what it is. And boy, I tell you what, when you went back to those, it was at a fire support base or wherever it was at, boy, the Blacks went one place, the whites went one place, the Hispanic guys went one place. It was just like separated, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then my friends that I had, my Black buddies, you know, that I had, we would, you know, meet and talk and stuff, or the Hispanic buddies that I had, you know, it was a small group of guys, you know, we'd get together even then. And but it was really separated at that time. And as the war went on, I imagine it even got worse, you know, worse than that.
I mean, I experienced that with just the times that I spent. I was on a reconnaissance support base in Ankay. Of course, you and I were in the same area. Yeah. I was there in 70, 71, so I was seeing the rapid disintegration of American involvement in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But I can remember being on, you know, we had a reconnaissance support base plus three fire bases, and I would travel to those three fire bases occasionally, usually being in a littered jeep on the road, traveling But I could see the separation of the black soldiers and the white soldiers on those fire bases.
You know, I remember one time my friend Mike, we were sitting talking. We were in the same hole one night. You know, a lot of times we were in the same hole at night. And I remember talking to Mike, and he said, "Did you see that? Did you see that?" And I said, "Well, what?" He says, "That guy's got a rebel flag hung on his rucksack." A rebel flag, this guy. The guy was from, like, Texas or something like that. And Mike said, "Did you see that?" Yeah. And I said, "No, I haven't seen it." But I know that within a week that flag was gone.
You know,
the Bloods got that flag, man, got rid of that flag.
The same thing happened to me. I remember a white soldier from Harlan County, Kentucky, that had a rebel flag. And I remember the tension of that.
Oh yeah, yeah. It got the tension of the black guys really fast, and so it disappeared. And so yeah, it went away really, really fast. Mike's got some really wonderful stuff he's going to read to us, and then we're going to talk about the stuff that he's written. A lot of really good stuff, and he has some stuff he wants to read out of a book. And Mike, you can tell the folks what you're going to do.
I do a lot of photography, and I'm mainly a photojournalist, and I took a fair number of pictures in Vietnam, but when I came back from Vietnam and realized that I had been used like a pawn in a chess game, so corporate America could get rich, it dismantled my core belief system. And I could talk a little bit more about that. But I did a photograph. I took an image, a picture of the names on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. in 1986, and that was the first time I went back and saw the memorial. And so I took, I just took a picture of the wall, and then I came back years later. I came up with an idea, and so what I did is I remember in 2000, I was visiting some friends in Pullman, Washington, which is where I went to high school. My father graduated from Washington State University in 1963, and so I went to high school there for 4 years. And I happened to be there, I think it was around 2000, and I went to a Pullman High School football game. And because they had a really good team that year, and I was with a friend, so we just decided to go to homecoming. Anyway, what I did is I took a picture of the Pullman High School team in formation. They're at the line of scrimmage. The quarterback is behind the center, and he's about to take the hike from the center. And so I took that photograph, and what I did is it shows all of the 11 players on the Pullman High School side, the offense, and then you can see the defensive players, and I don't remember who they played that night. But what I did is I superimposed that image I took of those high school kids playing football, and I superimposed them over the names on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial.
Oh, that's amazing.
So all you see is names. You know, you don't see the monument itself. All you're seeing is the names with that football image superimposed over it. And what I called it, I simply said, from the senior prom to Vietnam.
Yeah.
And so
that's a good one.
So I wrote a piece with that same title. I'll read it here, and then we'll discuss a little bit about it, the two of us, and I'm sure that you can certainly relate to, you know, to what I'm going to read here. So anyway, the piece is called "From the Senior Prom to Vietnam." It seemed like Vietnam was a hangout for teenagers. When I look at some of the pictures I took of fellow soldiers in my unit, it looked like I was looking at my high school yearbook. Senior Hall of Fame, most likely to succeed, was a picture that got my attention. Also, there was the picture of most athletic, friendliest, best dancers, most talented, best dressed, hardest workers, wittiest, cutest couple. Yep, they were all there. And a lot of them across America came home in caskets. In 1967, I went to a funeral of one of my classmates who at one time had been the starting guard on our high school basketball team. His name was David Michael Bradley. He went by Mike. In 1966, he joined the Marine Corps and went to Vietnam shortly after his combat training. It was a closed casket funeral because he stepped on a landmine and all that was left were body parts. The public was not allowed to see that, along with a million other things. Come to think about it, Mike was voted most athletic in our senior high school class. The Vietnam War, all the lies and all the body parts, where do they all come from?
Well, yeah, that's wonderful, Mike.
So, you know, and I remember looking at my, when I was writing this, I happened to glance and notice my high school senior annual on the bookshelf. And I started just thumbing through it, and I got to that part where it talked about, you know, the Senior Hall of Fame. In other words, the seniors and all these people that were, you know, that were selected as, like I say, most athletic, friendliest, best dancers, most talented. And I got to thinking about that because that was 1963. And of course, you know, we all know that on November 22nd, 1963, President John Fitzgerald Kennedy was assassinated.
Right.
So when I graduated high school in 63, you know, I don't think I even knew where Vietnam was.
Yeah, I didn't either.
You know, and then you fast forward. Right after Kennedy was assassinated and Johnson became president, the war escalated, and it escalated very quickly.
Very fast.
You know, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, you know, happened, and the Gulf of Tonkin resolution was passed. United States started bombing the Haiphong Harbor, you know, which is just right near, Hanoi. And so, like I say, everything escalated. Everything changed almost immediately. You know, the 60s just absolutely came in on full force by 1964.
Yeah.
64, 65, 66. And so it was just incredible. It was like an avalanche of things happening in our country.
Yeah. You know, when you're talking about friends that we knew in high school and everything, when General Hershey was in charge of the draft, General Hershey was, and General Hershey made a statement that really angered me, you know. He was saying that they weren't going to, they were not going to draft these men out of colleges and university and deny them a good education. You know,
okay. And
what that meant that he was going to go after the rest of us, you know, the poor kids that couldn't get into a university, the Hispanic guys that couldn't get into, our black brothers who couldn't get into universities. That's what he was saying. And when the war really escalated, boy, they just went through these small town draft boards and just scooped everybody
up, just
everybody up.
Yeah, I think that started, what would you say, 1965?
I would say 65.
But that's when the Marine Corps, that's when the Marine landed in
Da Nang.
In Da Nang.
Yeah, it really started then, and it just scooped everybody up. Everybody up. And you were talking about your friend who was killed in Vietnam. I remember after I got home from Vietnam, I didn't go outside very much when I first got back. I stayed in the house a whole lot. And then when I finally decided that, you know, I was going to go outside and I was going to go down to a little restaurant that I used to go to. Us kids used to hang out.
Right.
You know, so I went down there and I just couldn't go in. I just couldn't go into it. And so I went to a different place. It was real quiet. Older people hung out there because I felt like I was 70 years old. You know,
right.
I was 19 years old and I felt like I was 70 years old. And I was sitting there, eating, and a guy walked up to me, and it was a kid that I'd known in high school who had gone to Vietnam right before I did.
Right.
And he had lost his leg.
Wow.
And I remember him coming up and tapping me on the shoulder, and I jumped out of my chair, right? And he sat down, and we started talking, and he had changed 1,000 things. Before, he had been really happy-go-lucky. He smiled all the time, and he was just a really a nice kid, And then when I looked at him, here he was, man. He was just beaten. He was broken. You know, he was sad, and he never smiled when he talked. He never, not one time did he smile, Mike. His eyes were just glazed over, and he was 19.
I remember I had an experience when I first got to my unit, and we were in processing, and there was a line that was fairly near us, and what it was is it was a line of people that were going back to the United States after having served in Vietnam mm-hmm. for a year. And I recognized one of the guys that was in line.
Wow.
He was a lieutenant, and he was a friend of a very close friend of mine, because the guy that I saw in Vietnam was his fraternity brother.
Mm.
And when I looked at his face, I could see it on his face. And but I remember you years ago saying something that for me was very profound. I think I think you were talking about somebody asking you, you know, what was Vietnam like, Marvin?
Oh yeah.
And I remember you saying Vietnam was like riding in a pickup truck on a very, very bumpy dirt road, and you got a pistol to your head.
Yep. That's exactly how it felt.
And I never will forget that.
Yeah, that's how it felt. The whole time I was in Vietnam, I never was at ease, Mike.
Yeah.
I never had one minute of just, what would you call it, just no stress.
Right.
You know, it was always, you've probably, that's the same thing, because I know all my friends did. It was like we were always on.
Right.
Just, you know,
yeah, you were always hyper vigilant.
Always hyper vigilant.
Yeah, you didn't just, you know, I wasn't out in the field the way you were. I was on fire bases, and I was dealing with, you know, a lot of the stuff that was going on internally. I mean, we get hit every once in a while with a sapper attack or a rocket or a mortar round or maybe, you know, a small arms. I remember I was sitting on a bunker one time, and a sniper round went out over my head in front of me.
Crack.
And, you know, being, you know, in a barracks one night, and actually in Quinyon, I just got back from R&R from Hawaii, and I was on my way back to my unit, and I was staying at the transit barracks in Quinyon because I had flown from, when I flew back into Vietnam in Saigon, I flew to Quinyon, stayed overnight in the transit barracks en route to my unit farther north, which was on K. And I remember in the middle of the night, we're sleeping in, you know, in the barracks and on, you know, bunk beds, and the mortar rounds came right on top of us,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I can remember, you know, diving off the top bunk, and I remember getting under the bunk, the bottom bunk on the floor, and this guy grabbed me and just hugged me.
Mm.
And then one guy panicked, and he tried to run out of the barracks, and there was a huge fan that was at the end of the barracks because it was hot, you know, and so this fan was going, and it didn't have a guard on it.
Oh.
And he ran smack dad
those blades
right into the blades of the fan. And you know, it was dark, you couldn't see a thing. But it was always that feeling of hypervigilance.
Mm-hmm.
You just never
constantly
know what was going to happen. You didn't know whether, you know, whether there was going to be a shootout between two, you know, between two soldiers on your unit. You didn't know whether somebody was going to commit suicide. You know, you were just like I say, you were constantly hypervigilant. There was, you know, helicopters coming in with wounded, and so you had to deal with that. But you know, a lot of the internal violence, and I know that you didn't see as much of that, and because so much of the stuff that I was dealing with was just a rampant heroin addiction in my unit. You know, I was the chief medic in my unit, because I went to my basic combat medic training, and then after that I went to a 41-week advanced medic training
in
Denver, Colorado. So I was what they call a clinical specialist, and I was the and when I got to my unit, I was the only clinical specialist in the group. So here I am. I'm fresh in country. I'm an E3, and I, you know, and I got this position where I'm overseeing people that are that outranked me by one or two grades because of my MOS,
training,
which
yeah.
was a military occupational specialty. And so here I am in the middle of this, you know, being a new guy, and you know, not knowing anything. And then, you know, I can remember just I hadn't been in country very long when a 122 rocket came in and blew this huge hole in the ground. It didn't kill anybody.
Wow, lucky.
But you could have parked a Volkswagen in the pit of the belly of that that bomb crater.
Yeah.
You know. So, but like you say, you were always hypervigilant.
Always. I remember one time that it was in early in the morning, and we were dug in on the side of a mountain, and we were all dug in. And my friend, it was his time for guard, you know, watching, and I was sitting down at the bottom of this hole, and all of a sudden the mortar rounds, because you know, we knew once those mortar rounds come in, you know they're going to attack you, so these mortar rounds just start coming in. And I'd never thought I could make myself into a small enough ball to hide under a flak jacket.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's how afraid I was, right. That I just became a ball and hid under that flak jacket.
Yeah.
You know, and to this day, I can't imagine how I got myself that small.
I know,
to get under there.
I know, because their flak jackets
are very big.
I can remember riding in a Jeep with a flak jacket on, and I always rode shotgun, and I had my M16 over, you know, draped over my leg, and because I had my foot on the external extra gas tank, and I used to just put my M16 over my leg. But
and I tell you, it was devastating how I got underneath that. And when you think about that, day after day after day after day after day, with that much stress on you, it takes a toll.
Yeah, it does.
And you know, I remember going on R&R. We got, how many days did we get R&R? 5 days?
Yeah, five to 6 days.
5 or 6 days R&R, where you left the country and you could go someplace. And I remember I never even felt relaxed there.
No.
You know?
Yeah.
And I remember sitting around with some guys. I didn't know them. They were from different units. And we were at this hotel. I was in Australia or someplace. And we were all sitting around. And I heard one guy said, "I'm not going back."
Wow.
He said, "I am not going back. I can't do it. I can't do it." I don't know if he ever went, if he, you know, because the next day we all left to come back. And I don't know if that guy just said, "I'm not going back," and left.
Yeah, because I remember going on R&R to Hawaii. And I was married, and my daughter was born when I was in Vietnam. So she was born December 31st, 1970, and I saw her for the first time in March of 1971 when I met my wife and my daughter at in Hawaii, and we stayed at the Ilokai Hotel on Waikiki Beach. And I remember the contrast. It was the contrast I noticed of being in a war zone, and then all of a sudden, you know, 24 hours later, You're in Hawaii, staying at a really fine hotel. I'm drinking Primo beer, which was the most popular Hawaiian beers that was there. And I remember I'm We're taking the Pearl Harbor cruise. We rented a dune buggy and drove around the island.
Amazing.
You know, we walked on the beach. I remember buying a really expensive pair of boots. And we were eating in fine restaurants and on and on. And then after 6 days, I'm back in Vietnam. And the first day I get back, I get mortared.
Yeah.
You know, so it was that it was the profound contrast of going from a war zone to a place where everybody's, you know, having a good time, enjoying themselves, and there's nobody's talking about the war.
No.
And I'm sure it's no truth for those who went to Bangkok or
so
they
it
went.
It had to be the same,
right? Or went to to Australia,
mm-hmm.
or wherever. But it was that incredible feeling of, why am I in Vietnam?
It was dread.
Yeah.
It was just complete dread.
Yeah.
You know, and just this feeling of emptiness and fear and distress and everything. Good, Mike, you had something else to read.
This is a piece I wrote. It's called Confusion. And where the name Confusion came from is that on a firebase, it was Firebase Schuler. I remember you were.
You've been
on Firebase Schuler. So anyway, I remember, it was a heavily fortified, firebase. So we had 155-millimeter howitzers. We had 8-inch guns. We had armored personnel carriers. We had, M48 tanks with a 90-millimeter gun. We had, we had APCs. We had, remember the dusters?
Dusters.
That fired, 30-millimeter rounds, I think. The barrel of this 8-inch artillery gun, the crew had painted the word confusion. And it was funny because the first three letters, C-O-N, were slightly elevated above the next letter, which was an F. So you when you looked at it, you saw the word con. Confusion. And so anyway, on another note here, I wrote this piece because, I think one of the reasons why maybe, when I came back and I realized that I was the enemy in Vietnam, I think what happened to me is that, I was raised in the military. My father was a career military officer. I was born in Walter Reed General Hospital in Washington, D.C., and I was born on June 20th, 1945. And then we were the first dependents to arrive in Japan after the war.
Wow.
Our ship landed in Yokohama in February of 1947. Wow. And so we were there until 1949. My father was with the 29th Corps of Engineers. And what they were doing is they were making maps. And my dad had a high security clearance. And what they were doing is they were taking his unit. They were taking B-24s, B-25s, the small bombers.
Right.
They were low altitude small bombers. What they were doing is they were painting them white, taking off all the insignias, and they were flying over Korea, and they were flying over, China. This is like 1948, 49. What they were doing is they put some of the best cameras that the U.S. military had at that time. And what they were doing is they were putting them where the gun turrets were, the machine gun turrets. What they were doing is they were flying a low altitude over parts of Korea and China, and they were photographing the terrain.
Oh, boy.
And then what they would do is they would bring the film back, mm-hmm. and then my dad were making maps. And the reason I know that is because when I went to my father's funeral in 1994, his brother was there at the funeral, and my uncle Johnny had been a veteran of World War II, a veteran in Korea,
ooh.
And a battalion commander in Vietnam.
Good Lord!
So he was in three wars, and so it was that point, and it's something my dad had never shared to me. He was the one that told me about my father having a high security clearance and what they were doing as far as making maps, because when my uncle got to Korea, he was a newly minted lieutenant, you know, combat infantry, and they got maps issued of the terrain where he was, where he was at, and at the bottom of the maps it said 29th Corps of Engineers.
That was your dad.
So my uncle said those were the maps that my brother, my dad, when he was stationed in, you know, and had been stationed in, you know, in Japan in 1940, from 46 to 49, those were the maps that my uncle got in the field.
Well, that's amazing, isn't
and
it?
So,
amazing.
Anyway, I think a lot of it was that I think having been raised in the military, you know, we were in Japan, we went to Japan, you know, from 1947, 1949. Then we came back from Japan, and my dad was, it seemed like we spent a lot of time at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, where my dad was stationed. And then in 1953, 54, 55, we were in Heidelberg, Germany. And so I spent the first 11 years of my life in the military, on military bases. I mean, I can remember going and driving in a military bases, and my father being an officer, he was a captain, and he had a sticker on the front of his, you know, on the front of his bumper that indicated he was an officer. And I remember we would go through the base, and the guards at the main gate would snap to attention. Their jump boots would crack, and they would give my father the salute. And I'm sitting in the front seat of the car, and I'm thinking, my dad is God, you know. And so I was raised around that, you know. I mean, I think part of the betrayal I felt from Vietnam had something to do with my upbringing.
Oh, I'm sure it did.
To get back to this piece I wrote called Confusion, because when I came back from Vietnam in 1980, I got hospitalized because my PTSD finally got caught up with me. And you know as well as I do, by 1979, 1980, nobody knew a lot about post-traumatic stress. In fact, the diagnosis had just come out. In the late 70s, early 80s, they were finally dealing with it. So
you know what I was diagnosed with in about 1976? Manic depressant borderline schizophrenic.
Right. That's
what they did those guys.
I can remember, I think we've talked about this before. I can remember when I was doing my advanced medic training in Denver, Colorado, that I was on my psych rotation. Because we went through, you know, I covered every area of the hospital as a student for 41 weeks. The areas that we covered was the psych unit. And I remember observing shock therapy on an American soldier that was brought back to the United States from Vietnam with psychiatric problems. So here we are in a room, and he's got a mouthpiece in, and they're putting electrodes on his head, and then when they throw the switch, it was like his whole body got rigid. And just to observe that, you know, and that behavior. Because you know as well as I do, a lot of people were coming back from Vietnam who had emotional problems. Of course, we all know why.
Yeah.
You know that a lot of them were put on Thorazine.
I was put on Thorazine.
Yeah. And so anyway, and you know, you and I know a friend. I won't say his name right on the air, but he was stationed in the Saigon area, and I think outside of Benoit.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was involved in radio intercept, and you know the person I'm talking about, because we went to Vietnam with him in 1994, right. And I'll just say his first name is Jerry, and Jerry was involved in giving coordinates, bombing coordinates to B-52 pilots when they were bombing, and what he finally realized just with the people he was working, that the coordinates he was giving were civilian targets. They were not military targets. And we know that the United States bombed civilian targets on purpose in Vietnam. Because you do not bring the enemy to the peace table by just killing military combatants. You ultimately bring the enemy to the peace table by killing innocent civilians because they are military targets.
Right.
So anyway, Jerry when he finally realized he was given coordinates to B-52 pilots, he walked into the orderly room, and the lieutenant was behind the counter, and he said to the lieutenant, he said, "My tour of duty in Vietnam is officially over."
Yes.
And so, yes. Anyway, so he was flown back. He was flown back to the United States as a psychiatric hold. Can you imagine? They think something's wrong with Jerry because he got upset about giving coordinates to B-52 pilots to bomb civilian targets. Can you imagine? They think he's being treated.
It was his fault.
He's being treated in a psych unit. You know, he's making billfolds. You know, and he's depressed. And the military is trying to figure out why he's depressed. You know.
Oh God. Read it.
That's too much. Anyway.
12 minutes.
Anyway, this is a piece I wrote called Confusion. Okay. In 1980, I was hospitalized in a psychiatric hospital for 2 weeks because my PTSD was paramount, and it demanded to speak. I was terrified of the truth because I thought it would kill me. Mm. At one point, I was in a padded room because a therapist was trying to calm me down by making me play catch with a large medicine ball in this padded room. My anxiety and panic was threatening my life. I was pregnant with the truth, but I did not know how to deliver what was so suppressed inside of me. I was possessed by betrayal from the U.S. government that absolutely terrified me. How do you deliver a truth that threatens every aspect of your core belief system? Hidden inside of me was a powerful revelation. Every square inch of the Vietnam War was a total lie. Why did I want to end my life by driving my car over a cliff? Because I was thinking about doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I knew the exact spot on a highway that went through the Columbia Gorge that separates the state of Oregon from Washington. So I was contemplating suicide by driving my car over a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remembered a statement that was written by Viktor E. Frankl from his book, Man's Search for Meaning. An abnormal reaction to an abnormal situation is normal behavior. That statement kept me from killing myself. When you least expect it, the truth is delivered. I finally realized I was not crazy, and that was all I needed to know.
Yep, that's exactly right.
You know,
we have a lot of buddies and women that are Vietnam vets, you know, and how many of us had that same feeling. I mean, that same feeling.
I know.
You know? Go ahead, Mike.
Here's an excerpt of something I
go
wrote.
Ahead.
It's just a brief paragraph.
Sure, go ahead.
But I think it'll segue into just, you know, what I was experiencing.
Sure.
I wrote here, and this is just an excerpt of a larger body of information, mm-hmm. and stuff that I wrote. I wrote here, I said, I believe the self-inflicted destructive force behind post-traumatic stress is a silent enemy called betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
It is so insidious and pervasive that it has the character of a bounty hunter. Betrayal of one's own government based on lies to justify going to war for profit is a form of incest, what I often refer to as political incest. It is brutal deception by the fatherland. The general public and the military establishment would deny this reality because it would dismantle their core belief system. If what I am saying is the truth, they would have to rebuild their entire belief structure. This, of course, would be too painful. So denial becomes the holy grail. So not only does our government betray the soldier, but our society betrays the citizen soldier when they come home from war. The truth is always in the details, and when a returning soldier exposes national shame, that testimony has to be silenced. Moral injury is a taboo subject.
Mm.
Rabid societal patriotism is the lethal drug that kills countless returning soldiers and veterans who are eyewitnesses to the unspeakable. Here rests in emotional silence an American soldier known but to God. lying is the most powerful weapon in war. And of course, when I write here, here rests an emotional silence, a betrayed American soldier known but to God. That comes from the tomb of the unknown soldier.
Right.
Because it says in there, here rests in honored glory an American soldier known but to God. So I kind of took that from that, you know, because I finally realized that whenever the truth threatens one's core belief system, there's an urgent need to deny its reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened to us when we came back from Vietnam. Because when I tried to bear witness, and when you tried to bear witness to your friends and family, what we were doing is we were dismantling people's belief system.
Yeah, they didn't want to hear it.
And they simply didn't believe us.
Yeah,
And I never realized it was that simple. I never realized that what I was doing is I was dismantling people's belief system when I was trying to testify about the truth of the Vietnam War.
Oh, yeah, they did. I remember they didn't want to hear about it. I remember trying to talk to people about the war. There's two things people always ask, you know. First they'd ask, did you kill anybody? They always ask, did you kill anybody?
Yeah.
You know? And then when you wanted to talk about the war, about what happened to you in the war, and why you feel the way you feel, and do the things you do, they say, well, just get over it. Remember, how many times did they tell you, just get over it?
I know. I had a doctor tell me that one time when I was talking to him about my PTSD, and he said that, you know, you just got to put the war behind you. It was so funny
just
when he said that.
Just get over it.
Anyway, here's a piece I want to write. It's a really short piece.
Go ahead.
This piece came out of a book that I bought in 1977. It's called The Survivor, and it's by Terrence Dupree, okay? And listen to this. This is something that was such a powerful aha moment in my life when I bought this book.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the book was about the survivor was he was writing about people that were in concentration camps during the Second World War, and when they came back from that experience. Mm-hmm. And they tried to testify about what they experienced in those camps.
Mm.
This is what Terrence Dupree writes here. Because he says, the survivor then is a disturber of the peace. He is a runner of the blockade, men erect against knowledge of unspeakable things. About these he aims to speak. And in so doing, he undermines, without intending to, the validity of existing norms. He is a genuine transgressor, and here he is made to feel real guilt. The world to which he appeals does not admit him. And since he has looked to this world as the source of moral order, he begins to doubt himself. And that is not the end. For now his guilt is doubled by betrayal of himself, of his task, of his vow to the dead. The final guilt is not to bear witness. The survivor's worst torment is not to be able to speak.
Yep, that's true. That is really, really true. You know, just the betrayal that we feel. I even think that these flag waver guys, you know, that we see all the time, they got guilt too.
Sure they do.
We all have guilt, you know. They just do it this way, and we do it this way.
Right.
I remember being interviewed by, I think, Oregonian or somebody one time about it, and she was asking me questions, and she said, why do you do the things you do? And I said, we got to tell the truth.
Right.
We have to tell the truth about what's happening.
Exactly.
And she said, well, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Because people aren't listening to you. And I says, we're going to keep talking. We're going to keep talking.
Because I think that's what it is. Because we had such an obsession to bear witness.
Right.
Because I noticed that when you and I were going into the high schools, you know, 15 years ago, we've spoken just about in every high school in the Portland area, along with a few community colleges and universities.
Right.
Is that I'm obsessed, and I think you're the same way.
Mm-hmm.
We are committed, absolutely committed, to carry the message to high school students about the lies of the wars that the United States government gets involved. Because I have a picture that I have, and it's a shirt.
What?
It's
Let's wrap up.
Okay, here's the last one. Okay. When politicians and the rich start sending their kids to war, I'll start believing in noble causes.
Here you go. Thanks, Mike, and thank you for all you folks that are listening. Phil, please have your brother call the Montana Department of Veterans Affairs, 406-248-8579. And we'll be back Friday, January 19th at 9 a.m. There it is.
Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in a thousand different fights. I was there at the little big horse. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we won with a saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Hats for the Homeless donation drive. From now until December 15th, please drop off clean, new, or gently used hats, scarves, and gloves at the following locations: Cloud City Ice Cream on 45th and Southeast Woodstock, Cup and Saucer at 30th and Northeast Killingsworth, Fire on the Mountain at 57th and Northeast Fremont, Los Gorditos at 12th and Southeast Division, and here at KBOO Community Radio at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. The folks at Zippity News will pick up all donations on December 15th and distribute them to local shelters. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Bad Habitat album release party on Friday, December 15th at the Analog Theater and Cafe in Portland. On the eve of their 10-year anniversary, Bad Habitat will release their third album, Rock Speakers. Rock